which the Twister sucks you up. It's what we call a global killer. The end of mankind. It doesn't matter where it hits. Nothing would survive, not even that vehicle.
It's time to separate fact from fiction, science from myth, on the cutting edge of weather. Live from the weather capital of the world, Norman, Oklahoma, welcome to High Instability. Here's your host, Gene Roden.
Welcome to the 92nd edition of what's this show called again? Oh, High Instability.
Yeah.
Live on Shocknet Radio. A great show tonight. We've got a man that needs no introduction. David Hoadley is on the air tonight. We're going to be talking to him about, well, what else but storm chasing, the contemporary storm chasing. We're going to find out what he thinks about that and what kind of technology he uses in his escapades. All right, I'm your host, Gene Roden, alongside Two-Buck Chuck.
Howdy, y'all.
And the great wizard, RJ, pay no attention to that man behind the curtain, Evans.
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. The great and boss has spoken.
Yeah, high instability. I've got it.
That's supposed to be the name of the show, Gene.
Okay.
By the way, folks, I have not seen Gene, I swear to you. What, in like 5 months?
Yeah, it's been that long. Of course, we've talked on the phone briefly here and there, but
yeah,
it's been a long time.
Trying to get a hold of you is like trying to get a hold of a case of.
But you live out in the sticks here. This is deliverance country, RJ.
Sticks. The sticks.
You know, beautiful Southeast Normans.
You start hearing banjos about halfway out, and I'm just kind of looking
you
behind
saw,
me.
You
and,
saw the magnetic sticker on my my refrigerator, did you?
There you go. Yeah.
It's good to be back in the saddle.
It is.
Paddle faster. I hear banjos. That's what it says on.
Oh, seriously, yeah. Though, I mean, you finally what? You got internet out here, running water.
We actually earlier today the T1 line went down.
Did it?
Yeah, the thunderstorms last night apparently we had a few lightning strikes nearby. This morning apparently one of the cards at the shack that's a couple miles from here, one of the network cards, took a. Couldn't take
all
it.
All sorts of calamities occur out here, too.
It happens. Well, yeah.
Earthquakes.
You find bodies out here, yeah.
Cats and dogs living together. Yeah. Mass hysteria.
Yeah.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
Yeah. Pretty much.
Heathen flags flying out in front of my house. Right. I mean, I don't know who the hell thought about that stuff.
Since we had our last show, we had a 5.6 magnitude quake.
That I actually felt.
It was 45 seconds long.
Oh, boy, did I feel
it.
Yeah, like
how did it feel like
it
here?
Let me put it to you this way. I live in a concrete house, okay?
Mm-hmm.
When a concrete house moves quite significantly, mm-hmm. It's not quiet. And it certainly is very disconcerting. Yeah.
What was amazing
I'm
was
lucky I wasn't in the tower. I probably would have pissed my pants.
That quake lasted quite a while.
Yes, it did. Actually, it was here. It was about 35 to 40 seconds.
Yeah, seemed longer than that.
Yeah,
I thought it was around 45, but I don't know.
Well, I guess it depends on where you are. Now, remember, last year we had an earthquake that was centered just 2 miles.
But that was kind of a sharp, but
that was a sharp bang, and then there was a slow rumble, and then it was over.
This was a constant rumble.
Oh yeah, this thing. Yeah. My wife was home with me. We were sitting on the couch when it happened, and she was like. She just about fell over off the chair. She was so scared.
Of course, we had a whole series of aftershocks, if you want to call them that.
Oh,
for a period of a week or two after
that. Well, the big one that we had here was the first earthquake that I've ever felt, and I frankly hope it's the last. Yeah. I really did not enjoy
that. Well, I remember you had mentioned it. He had mentioned it. I can't remember. It was in an email or something that he'd missed one when he was overseas and he wished he could have been there.
Yeah.
Then he got here and he actually got into one. And
screw it.
This is not comfortable.
And if I lived near Prague, Oklahoma, I definitely would have earthquake insurance. That's for sure.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know what? I have to tell you, the jury's out, but I'm wondering how much fracking actually
from the
drilling, especially up there.
Still being debated.
Debated, yeah. And it'll be interesting to see how that all plays out over the next few years.
Yeah.
Because I'll be real interested in that.
Well, I don't think fracking is going to stop anytime soon.
They're just getting started.
Yeah.
Basically.
No, man.
Have you heard of Williston, North Dakota there?
Hey, if you guys want natural gas, come play with my ass, okay?
Yeah. But apparently Williston, North Dakota is the place to be. That's the boomtown of the 2000s.
Yeah.
And it's all due to the natural gas that they're finding.
Yeah, anyway. Lots of it, too.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, RJ, find out what has been happening the last, 6 months or so in the news. No, just kidding.
That'll take a long time.
Yeah.
Thank you, G-Man. You got 6 months worth of news? You need to call me or send me the memo or something on that because I've only got two stories. The big story, of course, the severe weather in the southeast again. Alabama is ground zero once again for some serious destruction. About 400 homes. Oh, shoot. 100 injuries. 2 deaths confirmed, by the way, in Jefferson County. 2 people confirmed dead in the county. Officials are looking at the report of a 3rd death, by the way. I haven't heard any more on that, so I'm not really sure if that's the case.
It's amazing that the fatality count isn't much higher, given the degree.
Well, they weren't violent tornadoes, apparently. So.
No. Of course, last April, massive tornadoes tore through Alabama, killing 241 people, including 64 in the Jefferson and Tuscaloosa areas. Storm, by the way, flattened homes, peeled off roofs in the middle of the night. In rural county community of Oak Grove, as dawn broke, residents surveyed the damage, began cleaning up across parts of central Alabama. In a sign that Alabama has all become all too familiar with severe weather, officials actually had to reschedule a meeting on Monday to receive a report on their response to the deadly twisters last spring. So, great irony.
And of course,
on that one.
The media has to jump in and say,
"Oh yes,
rare to have tornadoes of that intensity well, this time
even,
of year."
There's even more to that, and I'll defer that to Chuck.
Okay.
But you know, what did they forget? What happened last early?
It's
you know,
just always a shock to the media. They have a kind of early onset Alzheimer's. If it's more than 6 months ago, it just never happens.
Well, they've become basically their listeners. They have the attention span of a 30-second soundbite. So, anyway, moving on. This is an interesting story, and you know, I don't think I've heard anybody cover something like this, but I figured I'd throw it in the mix here. And we talked a little bit about it before we started the show.
Right.
Sophisticated as the modern climate models are, they're pretty sophisticated. One critical component continues to elude their precision: clouds. Okay, simulating these fluffy puffs of water vapor is so computationally complex.
You sure they're fluffy, RJ?
I don't write this. That even today's most powerful supercomputers, working at quadrillions of calculations per second, cannot accurately model them. According to Michael Wenner. He's a climate scientist at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. He says clouds modulate the climate. They reflect some sunlight back into space, which cools the Earth. But they can also act as a blanket and trap heat. He says getting their effect on the climate system correct is critical to increasing confidence in projections of future climate change. In order to build a breakthrough supercomputer, scientists like Wenner need, researchers are now looking to the world of consumer electronics like microwave ovens, cameras, cell phones, where everything from chips to batteries to software is optimized to the device's application. This co-design approach brings scientists and supercomputer engineers into the supercomputer design process so that systems are purpose-built for scientific applications such as climate modeling from the bottom up. According to Wenner, co-design allows us, he said, to design supercomputers to answer specific questions rather than limit our questions by available machines. In a paper titled Hardware Software Co-Design of Global Cloud System Revolving Models, recently published in Advances in Modeling Earth Systems, Wenner and co-authors argue that scientific supercomputing community should take a cue from consumer electronics like smartphones and microwave ovens, start with an application like a climate model, and then use that as a metric for successful hardware and software design.
It's an interesting. Yeah.
Now, of course, let me get this straight. You said that they're designing these computers to model clouds.
Yeah.
So,
well, actually,
therefore we
it's
have
a climate
the
model, but it includes cloud model.
Okay.
Yeah, I think we need to take a cue from Apple, like they did with Siri.
We could really this is a definition for cloud computing then, right?
Yeah. So you ask a computer.
Yeah.
You say instead of Siri, you say Cirrus. Cirrus, at what height will I see crystallization on this with this particular parameter?
And it'll look
at you and go, "I'm sorry, I'm not programmed to answer that question. Would you like to know how to get to Google?"
An idealized world where money isn't a problem.
Back in the Stone Ages,
a good idea. I don't know.
Back in the Stone Ages, the dawn of scientific computing, it was considered a breakthrough to have what they call and what we now use as a general purpose computer. In other words, the previous computers essentially were analog computers,
which were
perfect purpose designed.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the digital computer was the general purpose computer.
Right.
That was considered a breakthrough. Now, the argument that I think I hear this guy making is that computing is the major stumbling block to understanding clouds. And I think that's probably something of a misstatement.
Yeah.
Obviously, if indeed a purpose-designed computer is more efficient at the simulations that we're trying to do, and in fact can incorporate more physics and explicitly,
mm-hmm.
By the way, the term they use, cloud resolving, I doubt if there's any cloud resolving climate models. There may be a cloud allowing climate model, but I don't think there's one that
resolves
clouds. But our understanding of clouds is probably not limited only by computers. I would say, and Gene and I were talking about it before the show, I certainly agree with Gene that observations are a really big, important component, and we just don't have much.
Right.
So, and it's very hard to get direct measurements in clouds for a number of reasons. And indirect measurements have to be verified as meaningful. So somehow, we've got to bootstrap our way through that problem, and it's not going to happen overnight.
Interesting idea to toil with.
But it's an interesting idea. As you say, you don't hear that on every weather radio show.
Thank you, G-Man, and also thank you, Abacus Calloused Hand Chuck.
All right.
Your time's coming, RJ.
I'm going to have the feeling.
Oh, wait a minute.
It's true. What?
Of course, it is 12 after 7, where we're going to give our guest a call pretty soon.
Okay,
I've got the brown bag here. And of course, you asked what it was.
You're not one of those suicide bombers, are you?
I told you what it was.
You know, if you put a turban on your head, you might actually look like one of them.
It's a brown bag.
Oh, it
but,
is.
Okay. Heather and I missed your.
You missed my 50th birthday.
50th birthday.
Yeah, I was really sad about that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so
but
on the air tonight,
you were protecting the nation at work.
We've got.
I love you for that.
Yeah. Two lovely gifts.
Two
parting gifts.
Not one,
for you.
But
okay,
two.
All right.
Just
number one.
It's the official Jesus sticky notes.
That's perfect.
Yeah.
Jesus.
There you are. And we expect you to use
Jesus
those on your desk
daily. Note to others. I will use these.
And
by the way, it's presented by from the mind of the Unemployed Philosophers Guild.
There you go.
Okay.
And, all right.
And this is the official. Evolving Darwin playset.
Oh yes, yeah,
that you can proudly
go right here in
proudly
the
display
yes.
in the studio.
Here. I will. Sweet. I'm actually going to tape him up here on my monitor.
It touts from fishman to genius in only 380 million years.
Uh-huh. Okay, I'm somewhere at fishman right now.
A slithering little slimy creature, all the way to a Darwin figure.
Actually, it looks like Chuck with a full beard.
Hmm.
You notice that?
There you are. Sir.
That's a nice suit, Chuck. So, when did you get that?
1800s?
Anyway.
Thank you, G-Man.
All right.
I appreciate it.
Should we sing happy birthday?
We're going to
when
break.
When we come back, a man who needs no introduction, David Holdy. An evening with David Holdy. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. Minutes after 7 o'clock in the evening, the G-Man alongside 2 Buck Chuck and the great wizard, R.J. Evans. The number is 866-400-6684, toll-free in the U.S. and Canada, 866-400-6684. Give us a call. And, well, tonight we've got David Holdy on the line for our guest. Good evening, David.
Good evening.
Hey, good evening,
you?
Dave.
It's nice to have you back on the show. Now, this is your second time to be on the show with us.
That's right.
And, well, how is the weather in Virginia?
Well, it's actually pretty mild. We've had a mild winter so far. Maybe one brief snowfall, just lightly dusting on the ground. But this has been warmer than usual.
I know. It's been warmer than usual here, too. We've had a couple of brief bouts with Arctic air, but of course it didn't last very long.
So. Nope. I like it, but, you know, that's just me.
I think this is the first year I've been in Oklahoma in 15 years that I haven't seen snow.
Yeah.
By this time of the year.
Of course, don't speak too soon. We might get
a storm
right
well,
there.
Yeah,
at
February,
the last.
February is always notorious.
And March and even April.
Well, yeah, March.
Who else is there with you?
We've got Two-Buck Chuck.
Yep.
Chuck Doswell and producer RJ Evans. So.
Okay.
That is your audience.
Yep.
Okay.
At least the studio audience.
Studio audience. We have a huge audience tonight listening to the show. So.
Plus the chat room.
All
right. Well, so you began, we've had you on the show before, and we don't want to rehash what we did the last show when we talked about your beginnings, 1956, storm chaser. You're considered the father of storm chasing.
Right.
But how's the grandfather part going?
Well, now, I'd say don't rush me on that. My daughter's expecting at the end of March, but I encourage people not to hand me a cane anytime too soon because I'm still technically dad until then.
Right. Well, you're going to like being a granddad. I love it.
Okay, well, that's encouraging.
Yeah.
So you must be bubbling over, though, with joy regarding that. So.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Well, there'll be some other bubbling over afterwards, I'm sure.
Of course. I remember seeing you in a National Geographic Explorer program, if I recall right?
Right, 1985 with my daughter. She was 11
and
years
Sarah
old.
Sarah was 11 years old, and you had taken her on a storm chase.
Right.
And this is the Sarah we're talking about.
She went on a lot of chases with you, didn't she, Dave?
Yeah, and incidentally, what's interesting on that chase was there was a video crew that came with us from Geographic, which we're working on the video aspect, but there's also a still photographer who was doing something for possible inclusion in the magazine. I don't know that ever came about, but the still photographer at the time who was with us was Chris Johns,
really?
Who's now the editor-in-chief of National Geographic.
Oh, my goodness.
He had a lot to do with the more recent tornado articles in National Geographic regarding the probe, the photographic probe.
I have a large print. Of a photo he made of myself and Sarah with a towering Q in the background that he gave
neat.
To us. So it's a nice little souvenir.
Yeah. Yeah, he's always kind of been in interested in storm chasing.
Yeah.
That's an interesting story.
Yeah.
Well, the media has always had a fascination with storm chasing, but I always have the feeling that it's because they sort of walk into the process thinking, well, these guys must be crazy. And so part of the motivation, I think, that the media seem to have all the time is to try to figure us out.
Yeah, but at the same time, I think they promote the craziness in the sense that they highlight the ones of us who are more on the extreme side. And that, of course, brings in the revenue and makes the ratings good.
I certainly wouldn't want to mention any names.
Redeemer. So, David, I wanted to talk to you about what you feel about contemporary storm chasing and compared to what it used to be like when you didn't even go out with a weather radio because, there was hardly any weather radio signals to receive in the first place.
Or GPS, laptop, cell phone, computers, satellite images,
right.
And even very many motels to stop at in those days.
Yeah, would you have a dowsing rod?
That was
a wet finger.
Times.
Yeah.
Huh?
And you lick your finger and stick it up in the air, or
no? No. You developed hopefully intuition after a while, but you had a lot of false starts and many blind alleys before you began to learn just visually.
But you did have things like flight service stations that you would stop at.
FAA
and weather service offices.
Well, what's called the old days?
Weather Bureau. That back then, yeah.
Right. Well, I don't know. Today, I think that there's a difference in what a chase means, I think, in the older days where they were more infrequently found. And also, I think, because there was less known of the storms then, they had more of a mysterious or a magical quality in a way. So when you got a good storm or a good tornado, it was very deeply moving, very, very exciting, and something you remembered every detail of that day. And also, over a period of time of missing many storms, you do acquire kind of a second and third appreciation, level of appreciation for not only the overall sky, but the country you're riding through. You learn about the history of it, the Plains Indians, the settlement of the West. So you begin to acquire kind of, you fill in the gaps with other things.
But you have to think about something besides the vortex in front of you, because
you've got the time.
You don't have that vortex in front of you very often.
Yeah. But I think today the difference is more that the and media helps to promote this. I think that chasers are more, they tend to esteem a little bit more the extreme drama of, say, getting in close, taking great risks, getting video of storms with debris flying through the air. They're not particularly photogenic, by the way, I might say. Nothing you probably will want to put
on
the calendar.
So these close things don't do a whole lot for you, is what you're saying?
Not for me. It's exciting for other people. But I think to some extent in that way, it kind of degrades the appreciation of the weather, of this great storms in the sky, because it focuses too much on the very small part of the storm, which is dramatic, but how many tornadoes
they're missing the bigger picture. Yeah.
Well, as Gene Moore put it years ago, he said, for these guys, it's not about storms, it's really about them and the risks that they're taking.
And
that just misses the whole point, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, and I think to that extent, it for new people coming in, newbies interested in the storm chasing, that's the first thing that they
that's
they
pretty much all
to.
They know then.
Right, and I think it makes for somewhat cheapens the whole aspect of chasing from my point of view.
Let me ask you this: do you watch any of the programming these days?
Used to watch it more a year or two ago, but I began to see repetitive, so much of the same thing. There's not really, in other words, there's not really any interest intellectually. It's kind of a repetitive. How close can we get? What are the risks we're taking?
It's a soap opera.
Ones we miss, but there's no real plot. There's no storyline to develop. It's just kind of the same narrow vision every time.
Well, let me ask a kind of different kind of question. In comparing today's chasers with the way it was when you first got started, one of the things that we've kind of glossed over here is that you had to develop your own methods for forecasting these so that you could be reasonably successful, right?
Right, and I think there's a difference there, as you say. It's mainly in spending the amount of time I did to develop my own system is, in a sense, making more of an investment of myself in the product at the end, in what I get, so that, in a sense, I'm more committed, I'm more part of the experience because I've spent longer dealing with it than people who maybe just go to a couple of websites and get some data on their computer, and then they think they've got the whole picture.
You and I had spent some time talking about your methods, and you shared a lot of what you had done with me, and I have to admit that I was mystified by what you were doing.
Well, I expect you still are.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody understands it except me. That's all right.
No, that's fine.
You don't have to apologize for your reasons.
That wasn't my point, Dave, but I'll be happy to apologize.
Well, we'll skip over that.
For my ignorance. My ignorance knows no bounds. But I do.
But it worked for him.
I do enjoy the fact that you were successful using a system.
Right.
That is, needless to say, at least from my perspective, pretty far outside any of the sort of standard methods that I was trained in and educated about.
Right.
So in a sense, you're a self-taught and self-educated storm chaser, which I think is really remarkable. And I think in comparison to a modern chaser, I just don't think these extreme chasers have a clue about what was motivating us and how we went
modern
about
chasing them. Has really turned into more or less radar chasing.
Yeah.
You turn on your laptop, you download your SPC data. The forecasts nowadays are really
they're much
really
better than they
much
were
back
then. Oh sure.
And for the big days,
the odds of success are a lot greater, of course.
Yeah.
So you position yourself in the highest risk area, or slightly to the west or northwest of the highest risk area, and turn your radar on. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's really a very different kind of experience.
Sure. Yeah.
Than
yeah.
what we had. I didn't have to develop my own forecasting methods. I was trained in certain techniques for doing that.
Sure.
But we still had to go out and we would chase on our forecast. And we, since we didn't have that kind of real-time feedback, if there was some obstacle to our vision, like low clouds or, yeah. or whatever, we could be within 10 miles of a great storm and not even see it.
And every so often, I will see on the Internet a message for or somebody posting something. Most recently, it seemed like a couple months back, it was Eric Rasmussen. Well, I shouldn't use names. This is not embarrassing anyway.
No.
But he was saying something I've read other chasers, veteran chasers, say many times that some days they just wish they could kind of get in the car, throw in a weather radio and a couple of cameras, and just take off and go chase based upon what they know and what they see,
yeah.
as opposed to being encumbered with so much in the way of technology, with computers, laptops that sometimes don't get the signal or jam or too many people in one area for one tower, and they get kind of too tied in with technology, so they don't kind of forget to kind of become a part of what they're chasing.
Yeah, and it actually, you know, one thing that I've also heard veteran chasers say is that sometimes it's nice to just sort of put the cameras down
and actually
and
see
just
it through
take
out
it
a
take it in without yep. looking at yeah. it through a viewfinder.
Yeah. Because in a sense, if you think about it, you're freeing yourself.
Yeah.
When you're already out in the open plains, you shouldn't be out there in the wide open spaces tied to some small bit of technology or five or six
right.
things in your car. Being able to kind of just see and enjoy and be part of the experience is a kind of freedom.
But see, that would never sell on the Discovery Channel.
Well, they wouldn't understand, though.
No, that's not what the media and other people, and I think many modern chasers, think chasing is all about.
It might sell on NPR.
Yeah.
Do you feel it's bad, though, that people go out there and
no.
get these videos to try and recoup some of the costs of following these storms?
No, and I know they, many of them will get many more than I will when I'm out there on any given day. But, it's at this point, kind of you stand back and you say, well, this is the way the history of chasing is going.
Yeah.
And you kind of stand back as an observer and you look at it and you say, okay, I can't change it or divert it.
Right.
I can just kind of look at it and write it down and note it with the curious interest and see where it goes.
Speaking about that,
yeah, well, you know,
I want to ask you to tell the story of our correspondence regarding the future of chasing.
Of course, this
took place several years ago
with the storm track
right.
funnel
right.
funny that you had drawn up, and this was of a phone booth in downtown Benjamin, Texas, the square in Benjamin, Texas.
Okay,
with chasers lined up, and at that time, I think laptops were really new, and everybody used an acoustic coupler.
Right.
And they were lined up.
Yeah,
exactly. And the response to that was, is he kidding? Well, this is a funnel funny. This is never really going to happen. I mean,
Dave had commented at some point in Storm Track about the possibility of storm chasing turning into the next big craze.
Just another wild hang gliding.
Bungee cord jumping
right.
hang gliding and stuff. And to tell our listeners about our discussion.
Well, I was thinking about the problem of it in those days when you didn't have laptops, but you had to get in line maybe to go to the FAA flight service or whether we were get data or acoustic coupler at some phone booth in some isolated town. You had a row of people lined waiting to go with it. It would become so popular that we'd have to wait in line basically for data for, you know, half an hour or so. And I was concerned about that.
Especially at 4,800 or 9,600 baud.
Yeah. Chuck kind of commented in one of the newsletters saying, I think Dave is a little bit overly concerned. It really won't be that bad. And I really think that it's just not going to come that way. So, fine. So,
what was Chuck's thought processes regarding why did you feel that
I had a vision of what storm chasing was about, and that's sort of what we've been talking about, that storm chasing was about personal, serious dedication. It was about learning about storms so you could be a better storm chaser. It was about becoming knowledgeable and applying the knowledge that we have gained in science to the task.
And that means a much smaller core of people that would do all that.
And furthermore, the rate of success was relatively low.
Right.
We didn't go out and see tornadoes every day. And so my basic perspective was that most people might try it, and if they tried it and go out and have the same kinds of experiences that I was having without the benefit of all the education and training, perhaps they would be even less successful than I was.
Sure.
That that most of them would bail out after the first few times. And so my perspective was
so the built-in penalty function.
There was a big penalty function associated with failure that I think you would have to be very committed to severe storms and meteorology in order to survive that.
And I believe that Chuck opined this view sometime in the early 1980s.
That's right. Huh. Well, I don't remember the exact date.
Well, no, it was 83 maybe. I don't know, something like that.
Yeah. So you felt that maybe...
You were nice enough to send me a copy of our correspondence just to remind me of how stupid my forecast was.
So is this framed and on the wall that reminds you?
No.
It was simply a historical document. I said it with the best of interest.
Yeah, yeah.
No criticism intended.
But I have to believe that you probably got a kick out of sending it anyway.
Yeah, well.
I was obviously completely wrong about a lot of things there.
So forecasting is improved to the point where in big days, they are nearly spot on.
Yeah.
And technology is improved to the point where it's not really too difficult to
get... You don't have to know much meteorology.
An internet connection. So your penalty function that once... existed.
Yeah.
Is
success is fairly, a lot easier to come by.
Fairly been erased.
Yep.
What you do have to acquire as a perhaps a new level of knowledge is when you're on the shoulder of those country roads on weekends when you have a moderate or high risk is to be sure to use your turn signal and look very carefully in the rearview mirror for the mile of cars and vans that are racing up behind you trying to get ahead and trying to get the storm.
Brought to you by the Internet.
Yeah.
Yes. So traffic control and traffic expertise becomes much more important.
We chased a storm years ago. Up by Woodward, and it really was the first time that that I encountered the problem where we couldn't even find a place to pull off the highway. There were so many chasers.
Wow.
And
of course, on big days where there's only one or two big storms, that's a big problem.
It was May
26, 1991. Yeah, that's the day I thought you were talking about.
And essentially, it was one big storm. Now, there were other storms.
There was that one other big storm
by Wichita.
East of Wichita near El Dorado.
And so essentially, everybody was sort of funneled into a small road network. And it had gotten so bad, I don't know how many vehicles were there, but we literally couldn't find a place to pull over. We ended up driving east of town, east of Woodward, in order to find a place to watch the storm.
That's what happened with me on the Harper, Kansas day in 2004. I was coming down the road just north of Harper, and I couldn't find a place to pull off. All the side little farm roads, little roads going into the fields, a farmer took, everything was packed solid. I eventually just pulled off on the shoulder as far as I could get. I think my tires were just on the asphalt, and the car was about a 20-degree angle. I just leaned against the car and got my video camera out, and that's what I took. But there's no place else I could go.
Yeah. Well, I was astonished in 91 that storm chasing had grown to the extent that we had that problem then. Of course, by 2000s,
it's
normal
occurrence, sure.
And especially if there are limited road options.
And I would say, you were talking about the future of chasing. I would say probably, and some chasers have already commented on this, that it may be that it's going to happen that the veteran chasers will wait later in the season, go further north and west, up the Dakotas, Nebraska, Montana,
yeah,
Wyoming.
But even there,
there's
I think it's
chaser
becoming
convergence.
A problem. And, yeah. and when you get into remote areas, there are fewer roads.
That's true.
And those roads are not built to handle the amount of traffic that comes with an isolated big storm. And you have even fewer places to pull over. And
yeah, well, I still think that, for the most part, the most egregious chaser convergence
is still Oklahoma,
yeah. Kansas, North Texas in May and June.
Yeah.
But I think we're going to see more chaser convergence in other times of the year and other places. It's inevitable.
One thing I think, and maybe taking the broader view of this, that if we step back a moment, while it may be inconvenient, perhaps as a too soft a word for the veterans to deal with these sort of things,
yeah.
The spread of knowledge about severe storms through this whole culture, this whole emphasis on weather and what the networks have done, have educated, I think, a great many people, so probably has resulted in saving a good many lives over years and over the plains.
Well, I certainly hope that some of the things that we've done as a result of storm chasing have contributed to that.
Although you see some of these videos on YouTube where these people have gone out not knowing anything about chasing storms other than jumping in a car and heading out after a dark cloud,
yeah.
And actually finding themselves in a tornado.
Yeah, but what I'm referring to is just the average person, not the chaser.
No, I mean, that's what I'm referring to as well.
Yeah.
Average people are participating in chasing when it pops up in their backyard.
Right.
Yeah.
I saw that the day of the Elmina storm. What is that? June 3rd, 99. Some guy and his kids pulled up in a pickup truck.
The kids in the back?
The kids in the back,
yeah.
And the driver was drinking beer. And he says, "Whoa, is there a tornado?" Yeah, it's right there. But so there's a certain amount of that that happens now that didn't used to happen.
Yeah.
But I have to agree, Dave, that I think collectively chasers have contributed to science and contributed to storm spotting, and indirectly then lives have been saved by storm spotters that we've helped to train and to recognize things.
And I think the same thing goes with the tour groups that go out, too. At one time, I had mixed feelings about that, but I thought about it a little bit, and I thought, well, look, these people are learning about the weather and about where to find storms and how to avoid them. They're going to go home and talk to their relatives and their neighbors, and this knowledge is going to spread, and it has to have a ripple effect. It has to have a net benefit for a great many people.
Yeah, other than the liability issues regarding tours, they've kind of grown on me as well.
Yeah.
If you don't know anything about storm chasing, why not go with a seasoned veteran or two and go on one of these tours? So,
yeah.
Well, it is now time for a break.
Okay.
We'll have more to talk about.
Yes. We're going to talk to David Holdley about technology and David Holdley. I don't know if that's an oxymoron, but we'll find out when we come back.
This segment of HI brought to you by Weed Trimmer Beyond Ass Cheeks Wipe Your Butt Toilet Blades.
Captivating, mesmerizing, clever, and humorous. High Instability continues in a moment.
About 5.5 minutes till 8 o'clock in the evening. It's 44 degrees outside. Damp and dank. The number is 866-400-6684. Toll free in the U.S. and Canada. Give us a call. Now's your chance.
Come on, guys. Give us a call. You can talk to Dave Holdley.
David Holdley, yes. All right. You back, Dave? Hello.
I'm here.
All right.
All right, what we were talking about, contemporary chasing.
Yeah.
And that brings to mind, what does David Holdley use
for
technology when he's out storm chasing? Does he have a laptop and a GPS and a portable radar system, or what does he have?
Okay, I take a laptop to motels. I get my morning forecast data there. And
still using your method?
Yeah, I'm still using the old one.
All right.
Acoustic coupler?
No, just kidding. No running boards either. Come on, guys. But last few years, I've added a cell phone with a weather website where I get radar, dew point, surface maps, and so forth. And I find that very useful. In fact, I've caught a couple of tornadoes using that.
Yeah.
But I don't rely on radar that much. And I'll tell you a little bit of a caution I have, but I think great emphasis on current radar and seeing echoes and so forth is that sometimes where you're seeing activity now is not necessarily where the storms will be 3 hours from now.
Yeah, that's
and
true.
I think I tend to find there's a lot of value in doing a good morning forecast, whether you use just surface or use everything else, because the dynamics aren't going to change that much when the surface starts to pop. So I think that if you've done a good analysis in the morning with a kind of a measured use of radar in the afternoon, then that's probably the best mix.
Yeah, I remember back in the old days, this sounds like an old fart for sure, back when we had no access to things like radar, you would see storms developing in a place where, other than where you had forecast, and the temptation, of course, was to go running off after those.
The grass is greener on the other side,
you know, and then, of course, what would happen would be if you chase them, where you had predicted it was going to be would erupt into great storms, and the ones that you went after
it's
would die.
It's called doing the Texas two-step there.
Yeah.
You get caught in between when you do that.
We'll give you one example, which one of many that I just happened to think of while sitting here, was May 19th of 2010, the storm that occurred near Hennessy started there. We had a number of tornadoes. I think that was a weekend storm when they had a lot of traffic jams and so forth. Anyway, I was with some friends, no names mentioned, who were on the other side of that, and they saw it when it started, and then they said, I need to go south. I need to get away from that area. Well, it looked to me very dynamic. In fact, I could see rotation continue as it moved east, so I kind of gave up and went with them because they had the radar and everything else.
Uh-huh.
And I missed two or three tornadoes that popped up later
near
Stillwater from that same system.
Yeah.
So, again, there's some value about when you've had a lot of experience and kind of looking and seeing what the sky looks like. It's sometimes risky to a gamble to kind of throw that away and go with the technology because it isn't a silver bullet every time.
Yeah. So I've been deceived by lots of things over the years in chasing, and that includes having access to modern data sets.
Right.
I can remember a chase not so long ago. I don't remember the year now. I'm trying to forget, actually. where we left Norman, we drove up to Salina, and the winds had veered around. They'd gone around to southwest, and the dew points were falling, and I just said, screw it. We're sunk. Dry line's gone through. End of story. And by the time we got home, of course, I'm hearing stories about the tornadoes up northeast of Salina. And apparently I had been deceived by what amounted to a very brief period where the winds had veered around.
Yeah.
And then they backed around and everything essentially unfolded as I had predicted. But I'd been convinced by the local data and my access to it that it was going to be a bust. So even with access to modern data, it's still pretty easy to screw up.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that many times. But at the same time, this is what gives value to what we do. When you catch a good storm, you put a lot of investment into it. We've had a lot of busts, and you finally get one after a couple of days, and then you feel great. You feel like, hey, I nailed this, and once I was right.
Yeah.
David, let's talk about one of your more memorable chasing events. Can you pick one out that really stands out where perhaps everything went right? Perhaps you got there as the first towering queue were going up and you watched its entire evolution from towering queue to behemoth tornado producing supercell?
Right. Okay. Well, there are two of those days. I don't know.
So they're very few and far between.
Well, there are a couple. I don't want to repeat what I did 3 years ago, but let's see what I can pick out here. One of them was, of course, the Harper day of May 12th of 2004, when I came up from Oklahoma, and actually my forecast initially that day was for western Oklahoma, didn't even include the Harper area, but it was close to it. But I went visual. When I got into the area, I just followed the towers. I went on a little road that was right parallel to Cell, was moving west to east. I got four tornadoes that day. It was an easy drive. The other one was memorable was the June 24th, Centerville, South Dakota. And I think it was the day,
It
was the same day that I think Samaras nailed a big one further north there, wiped out a little town. Anyway, that one.
So you and I were on the same storm that day.
You were on a little west of it. I think it was a little east. Yeah. I got a road going north. It was right parallel with the Cell. You could watch the wall cloud form at the very beginning, drop into funnels, right next to the highway with excellent sunlight to the west, backlighting. Only about 3 miles, 2 miles, 3 miles to my west. I just followed up to Centerville, and I caught about 9 or 10 tornadoes that day. They just kept coming out. So those are some of the nicer days where you have
Did you use technology much on either of those days?
Both those days, I just used my old-fashioned surface map analysis. Mm. But keep in mind, of course, that this strange system where I make up my own terminology does reflect at some points actual meteorology. It's just
absolutely.
Like I give it my own name.
Absolutely.
And so I'm not doing anything that's particularly different than what somebody else would do, except I'm just doing it with my own language.
What are some of the terms that you tend to use in your maps?
I call convergence something different than most people. For me, convergence is actual winds that are coming together in direction, not just speed overtaking one another, say. Dew points. For me, a significant dew point is a 20-degree drop within 150 miles. Anything less than that, I tend to disregard. Anything greater, like 25 degrees, 30 degrees, then I pay attention and I alter my forecast to reflect that. So those are some of the things I use.
It's a very unique system. I felt all along that there had to be a scientific basis. It's just that you wouldn't be using the right vocabulary to describe it.
And let me just say, just a brief background, that the technique I have is based upon detailed study of hundreds and hundreds of surface maps over 30 years or so.
Sure.
And in each case, when I make a small change to my data, if something isn't working out right for me, then I go back and I reforecast all the data
that apply
to that. So I'm constantly going over old information, but it has value because I'm learning each time I go over it and trying to narrow down the options.
Yeah, my frustration certainly is not with what you're doing, but my inability to understand it. I would like to have figured out a science versus Dave Hoadley dictionary where you could look up one word in the Hoadley universe and you would find out what the word is in the science universe. But I was never successful with that.
Dream on.
I can only fault myself. It's certainly not your fault.
Well, it's never bothered me in particular because I understand the problems with the people who are in the field and have learned it differently, and that's okay. That's the way it is.
And that's the way I feel about what you've done. In effect, you are a self-taught scientist.
It is fun though. Once in a while, and I won't pick out dates at the moment, but every so often, almost every year, I'm out there. There will be at least one day where I'll wind up sitting right in front of the wall cloud.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the tornado will come down briefly, maybe it won't.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like I get there, and maybe 10 or 15 minutes later comes a whole horde of other people.
Yeah.
And those are the kind of days you kind of like to remember as an old-timer, saying, I can still stand there. Yeah.
And you've always been able to do it. The fact that our vocabularies are different has never diminished anybody's respect for what you do and how successful you are.
Well, in another context, too, that which we seek and we look for out there is the same grand sky for everybody. That's what unifies us. That's what brings us together.
I have to go down another path here. I want to direct some questions toward some things that popped up in StormTrack over the years. that I think many people failed to understand. And the one that
that I like to refer to. I talked about it during your celebration of your 50th anniversary as a storm chaser.
I do remember that, yes.
Is the cottonwood seed.
Oh, yeah.
From time to time in Storm Track, you indulged in creating poetry and things that were that had essentially only peripheral connection to storms. Would you like to talk a little bit about that?
Well, yes, I guess I could. And I think what this suggests is that the total experience of storm chasing for the veterans like you and me and others is a much deeper experience than just the tornado. But anyway, this one day, I was coming back from a chase. I think it was somewhere around Fort Smith, Arkansas, and I dropped down to Oklahoma and was coming across North Texas. And it was high had just passed over. I missed the storms while they were in Arkansas, and I was coming back and I had north wind and driving on the interstate, and it was a sunny, nice day, hardly any traffic, and the wind was blowing from the north. Initially, good 15, 20, 25, and I kind of noticed after a while the trees weren't moving as fast. They weren't shaking as much, and I got a little further down the highway, probably somewhere north of Denton somewhere, and I noticed a cottonseed or two from one of the trees drifting from the north. And, that's interesting. It's nice. And within about... not 5 miles. There was one cottonseed drifting from the south. And I just looked at that, clear blue sky, no clouds overhead, no indication of anything else that had changed except the direction of the wind.
Yeah.
And at that moment, I felt good. I was looking forward to the next day. I was thinking, I've passed the boundary. And the boundary might have gone all the way from central Texas to North Dakota, but I had crossed it, and I knew it, and it was a lift that is hard to describe.
Yeah, that's just really powerful stuff. I know it just knocked my socks in the creek when I read that.
And unfortunately...
But you're never going to hear those stories there on
Discovery Channel.
No, and I think that so many of the people, unfortunately, that are tied up with the technology, the radar and so forth, and getting out to the storms and chasing as many as they can over as wide an area... they're going to miss something like that. They're not going to have paid their dues in the way that Chuck and I and others have who have been out for longer.
There's a kind of magic. I have to tell this story. It won't take long, I promise. Al and I ended up going out on a chase, and we had camped. Al is not a camper. But we had camped, and we'd actually pitched a tent in the Paladuro Canyon.
In the canyon.
In the canyon. And in a place where you're not actually supposed to pitch tents. But we were up off the... We weren't going to get flooded.
No, okay.
But that night, the wind came roaring out of the south, and it howled all night long.
And you couldn't get any sleep
anyway.
And
we couldn't get any sleep. There's no way we were going to sleep. But I don't think either one of us felt bad about that experience because we knew what that wind was bringing.
Right.
And the next day turned out to be a fantastic chase day.
Yeah, you mean they actually had storms in the Texas Panhandle?
Yeah, back then.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Before global warming. Yeah. But, and that kind of experience, it's kind of hard to relate to somebody who's sort of focused on adrenaline and danger and all of that.
I stayed at the Holiday Inn last night. Does that count? No, just kidding.
Sounds like a serious personal problem to me.
Oh, that's so 2009.
Well put, Dave. No, it's just a whole different kind of viewpoint that we're.
And I think another point I was wanting, I have some looking at some of my notes here. We're talking about, I think, maybe comparing successes of different forms of chasing. And certainly, many of the newbies can take very little information, basic websites and radar, and they can do a good job catching storms these days. But at the same time, when I'm out there using the technique I have, it's usually not a question of not being in the right place. It's rather not being there early enough, maybe, to get in close. Mm-hmm. And part of getting in close for many of those people is going to be driving fast, and many of them do.
Yep.
And I think that, as I said in one of my talks, I think, hey guys, when you have to drive fast to get to the storm, you did not make a good forecast, period.
That's an implicit admission of a screw-up.
But does that really matter, as long as they get there?
As long as and they'll get there and they'll get some good video. I'll tell you one example, one case where I really felt badly about, and I will never do again. Now, it was some chasers I was chasing with. I won't give any names, but we started out somewhere around, down in Texas, still, I forget where it was, any west of
Sweetwater.
Abilene.
Sweetwater,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And we went charging. It was somewhere like that. We wanted to be up in North Dakota.
Oh, gosh.
Oh, wow.
Maybe
wow.
It wasn't that far south. Maybe we started. Anyway, the people I was with, we got out on these open roads up in Nebraska and South Dakota, North Dakota, and they wanted to get there as quick as they could. So we were driving 85, 90. Hmm. We were on open roads, no traffic, so we weren't endangering anybody. We slowed down for small towns, but in between them, we were burning rubber.
Sure.
And when we got up there, now, of course, there weren't any tornadoes. We didn't see anything, but we were taking a long shot gamble. But when we got up there, I was not only exhausted, I felt used up, and I basically felt ashamed. I hated myself for doing that, and I will not do that again with anybody, regardless of how great the prospect looks. I was simply trying to be good company and stay up with them, because if I slowed down and they would slow down, I'd feel badly about it. So I'm not getting that, and they understand that, and that's the bottom line.
Yeah, well, when you chase with someone, one of the key elements of picking someone to chase with is that you have to be compatible with what they're doing. If you're not, then you really shouldn't be chasing with them. And I've learned that over the years that I have to say that I'm probably not compatible with most chasers. Gene and I chased together one time.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, just once. But I'd like to do it again, actually. It was a great experience. And one of the reasons it was a great experience is we did not have to
be under the base of the storm.
We decided we didn't have to be under the mezzo in order to have a successful chase. And we both arrived at that conclusion independently. And so it was a very harmonious decision-making process. And so we had a great time. And it was a great chase, and we saw a great storm. Whether it produced a tornado or not is debatable.
Yeah,
but
given the type of storm we had.
It wasn't really important for what we were wanting to do anyway.
Well, one thing, of course, that the close-in chasers that go in for the dramatic, vortex swirling around and reflying through the air. One thing they are not going to see is the overall structure
That's
of that
right.
beautiful storm. And if you get the tornado on the ground and get the wall cloud, the inflow band, the striated bands, the anvil, the mammatus, hey, that's complete. That's the Mona Lisa.
Yeah. Right, right.
Yep. You know, it's been interesting. I've been watching Facebook now. I'm a regular Facebook participant, and Roger Hill's been posting a lot of images, and my sort of mental image of Roger Hill has been, you know, go for broke and get into the debris cloud. But
he's
he sure has an awful lot of
spectacular
photographs of storms where he was away from the mezzo and caught that amazing structure as well as the tornado. So, you know, I think I have to, I've been modifying my viewpoint about Roger's chasing, because I think he's begun, he's always been. Some of it is by accident, but boy, I'll tell you what, the images he's come away with are spectacular. No two ways about it.
What kind of film equipment do you use now, David?
Well, my current one is a Musil Canon DaVixia camcorder, and then I have a Canon about 2004-5, about a 5-megapixel camera, but I don't use that very much. It's mostly a little Canon now.
So you don't shoot any stills anymore?
No, rarely.
Really?
That takes tape still. I'm still using the tape. I have a friend who has talked it up, who works.
Historically, you shot transparency film.
Yeah, right. So I got slides, but I don't do slides anymore, and I rarely do stills.
Really?
Yeah.
I've gone the other way. I basically, the last time I chased, I didn't even bring a video camera. I just brought my, I have a still camera that I can use because it has an intervalometer for time lapse. But, you know, I have a high-end Canon for stills, and I'm focusing mostly on stills now.
Uh-huh.
And I'm kind of that way, too. I haven't shot video, and I don't know how long on a storm chase. I mean, you can shoot stills and you can shoot video, but if you want to shoot both, you kind of compromise.
You're going to compromise each of them.
It's a choice you have to make, and obviously you give up some things, but... Again, part of the experience, of course, is when you get back home, some cold November evening, you're sitting in your house and the wind and snow blowing outside. And
cold November evening? I don't know what you're talking about. We get tornadoes.
Well, you get my drift anyway.
Yeah,
anyway,
he's that way.
You can pull out a slide or a print or the video, but what you're remembering when you see those is not just what's in that little viewfinder or in that little screen on the TV. What you're remembering is the whole day and how the wind is tugging at your clothes, the dust flying through the air, the sound of the storm. That's your experience coming back. So that for a lot of us, it's bringing back a total experience, not just what you're seeing that one day.
And the improvement in the small little video cameras are amazing.
Oh, they're great. Oh, yeah.
High definition. Yeah. And
oh, yeah.
Yeah, I actually have been kicking around the idea of getting one of those little mini digital.
I mean, they don't cost much nowadays either. I mean, a few $100 and
yeah,
sure.
But I'm still going to focus on stills. I think chasing that's just more satisfying to me. But I, you know, you're exactly right, Dave. From the very first chase I went on. The idea of taking images, whether they be still images or movies, is to give you something to remind you of that moment in the future.
Yeah. Well,
to bring back those memories.
And the other thing, too, is keep in mind that my approach to spending money on the latest technology and new cameras has to balance a little bit with the fact that I'm starting out from Northern Virginia. I got to drive 1,500 miles out before I even start chasing that 1,500 back. So there's a lot of expense involved, and I'm always conscious of that. So I try not to. I try to put a brake upon unbridled excess purchases, and I try to be reasonable so that I can live with myself later.
Yeah. Well, you've always been reasonable, Dave. I don't think anybody that I know of would ever accuse you of being unreasonable.
Well, no, I'm talking about my opinion of myself. I have to live with myself.
Yeah.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, I would think you'd find it pretty easy.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about, you know, we've talked about where storm chasing has been and where it is now. And so what does David Holdley think about where it's going to go, given that you made this prediction about storm chasing becoming a, you know,
trash sport.
A trash sport, if you will.
Yeah.
Where do you think it's headed? You think it's going to revert? You think it's going to go full circle, or what?
Well, you know, that's a tough question, and I get that often, and I really don't have a good answer at this point in chasing. I think that
are we going to hit a critical mass where storm chasing is disallowed?
No, I don't think so. I think it's more likely that, I'm not aware of that much crowding at so far out on the plains the last couple of years, except for one or two days like the weekend in Oklahoma, the Hennessy storm. That was the battle storm in South Dakota. There were a lot of people around, but that.
You don't think it's going to continually get worse year after year? You think it's just going to kind of regulate itself?
I don't see that as much. I think that the expense of doing this for the average person. Even if they got a rush seeing some of the things on the Learning Channel or the History Channel, whatever, they're going to find that it takes more time than they thought it would, and it's costlier. And I don't see an exponential, I guess that's the term, increase. I think maybe an incremental increase over time, but I don't think it'll be quite that bad. But
I'm going to go out on a limb here, even though I've done it unsuccessfully in the past.
Oh, quite on a new limb.
I think there was a time lag between Twister and the impact on chasing. A couple of years, really, before we saw much of an impact from Twister. But I think the impact of Twister pushed a lot of new chasers out into the field.
We need a Twister, too.
And I think, yeah, well, I don't even want to go there. But I think the Discovery Channel program will have its own incremental impact on storm chasing, and I think it'll push another bunch of new chasers out into the field.
Well,
Reed Timmer wannabes. And so I think we'll see that increment. Now, whether it's exponential or not, I doubt if it'll be exponential.
Yeah.
But I think we'll continue to see some growth for
Maybe growth in the wrong area as far as perspective and
I'm not going to say right or wrong, but yeah. I'm going to say that it'll be people whose vision of chasing was molded by Reed Timmer.
Let me add to that. I think I could. There's one thing I do feel that will come, which I've been toying with over the last couple of years, but I know it's been raised various times, but it's been argued down and talked against. First of all, I think as with the increased number of people, there would be at some point, we all talk about the possible fatalities may occur, at some point a chaser or a group of chasers may, of course, strike a family car or a school bus or some terrible thing like that, and people will die as a result of that.
Mm.
The media could take off on that, and we could get a real black eye. Now, that raises in my mind, although it would be late in the game to do so, something that's been discussed, but I don't think it's been exhausted. I think it still is a lively topic with careful development and consideration. The idea is, should chasers have an organization?
Mm-hmm.
And I think, for instance, and I don't think it has to be necessarily restrictive, it has to be burdensome, but I think that some kind of organization, for example, establishing standards for ethical chasing, consider ways to maybe certify responsible chasers. How do you deal with repeat offenders who speed all the time? And I think most important, and these kind of add to the bottom line, some central point to act as a spokesman to the media, as an advocate, to correct the public image of us, which may be bad for times. I think that if there was an organization like that, that might help to, in a way, make us seem a little bit less crazy and a little bit more sane and more responsible. Now, I know that people talk it down. They say, we're free agents. We don't want to be burdened. Yeah, fine. I respect that and understand it. I think that, though, talking about the future, 5-10 years, I think it's got to come. And I think that at some point it will do a service, and it doesn't have to be oppressive. It can just be helpful.
I get the feeling, though, that that the chasing community everybody talks about is
really
non-existent for the most part, and it would be very similar to trying to herd cats.
Yep. We tend to be free spirits, and there are as many reasons for chasing as there are chasers. And obviously those reasons and the individuals, that has an impact on how they approach chasing.
Where, I feel in an idealized world that your idea, Dave, would be great. But, that would be difficult to do.
Well, I'm not exhausting all the possibilities, just the brief comments I made. I'm just saying that there are many ways to approach that, and there are many ways you can express it, and maybe not the ways I have, and maybe things that other people think about. But I think that at some point it makes sense and maybe would be useful to chasers to have some place where they can say, well, we belong to this, here's my card, I am a member, I am so forth, and some cop stops you somewhere on the road, and you say, well, I've taken the course, or I've practiced safely, and the guy looks at it and says, oh, well, yeah, I've heard about that. Okay, well, you be careful next time, something like that. I don't know.
Let me be the czar of chasing. we'll have, concentration camps for violators. We'll send them to some place where there are no storms.
I say just put shock collars on all of them.
By the way, I want to, well, I have the slightly different subject here. Did I mention, and correct me if I've done it, have I mentioned in our last talk about Luke Howard, the British amateur weatherman who developed the name of the clouds.
No, let's do that after our break and after our Two-Buck Chuck segment.
Right. Sure.
We'll talk about that.
Okay.
So stay tuned, and we'll be right back and have the Two-Buck Chuck segment for this week. Now, it is now time for the Two-Buck Chuck segment for this week.
He's loose. He's on the hunt. Dare to go face to face with Two-Buck Chuck.
This is Two-Buck Chuck. Coming at you from ShockNet Radio Studio B, here in the monument of priapism that belongs to RJ in beautiful Southeast Norman. Well, I got to hit this softball that's been lobbed at me. We just had a tornado outbreak in the Southeast. Some tornadoes track down paths very similar to those that were that occurred on the 27th of April last year. And Diane Sawyer on ABC News World News Tonight got up there and announced to the world the incredibly counterfactual statement that the tornadoes struck without warning. Not only that, they compounded it by telling their viewers that there was a program that FEMA had that they could participate in that would help them obtain warning information. And unfortunately, that program doesn't exist. So once again, we have a marvelous example of the fact that the media are basically not interested in the facts. Gene talked about it earlier tonight. There's this nonsensical notion that every time we have a tornado outbreak in the Southeast in January or February, that it's some kind of fluke occurrence, that it's some kind of freak event. Balderdash. For those of us that know something about the data, that know something, that have actually got a memory, we can look back at the data and we can say, you know, look, that's just not a fluke event. It happens with some regularity. This is the Southeast. They have a severe storm season that doesn't look like Oklahoma's. And so their severe storm season actually peaks in what we would call the winter. So this isn't some sort of unusual event. And of course, the nonsense that these were storms that struck without warning makes for good news, I guess, although it's hard for me to imagine why. But this stupid cliche gets aired on a regular basis. And it just bothers me a lot that the news media has this aversion to fact-checking. I've had a number of occasions where I've had dealings with various media folks. And the number of times that they've called back and done fact-checking exercises is, you know, I can count those on the fingers of one hand. It's very rare these days. It seems to me that journalism ought to be based on facts. Is that so hard to understand? And if you're going to have facts, let them be accurate facts. Why can't we have accuracy in the news? Why do we have nonsense in the news? What this does is that it undermines my confidence in the news as a whole. When they talk about something that I know something about, I'm constantly finding problems. Now, yes, I agree. I'm a nerd. I'm a geek. I'm whatever pejorative term you want to apply to somebody who cares about a subject. But if they can't get the facts right in my subject, why would I have any confidence in their ability to get the facts right in any other subject? And I know enough from talking to colleagues and other people that when they talk about some other topic, they're usually wrong there too. Well, the duty of the
of the free press, the reason that they're protected in the Constitution is so that we get accurate information. The public needs accurate information in order to make decisions about what to do, how the government should run the country. And if we don't get accurate information, then our decisions are likely to be poor. This is unacceptable. It is unacceptable, people. And if we don't do something about it soon, our country is going to be so deeply embedded in a sea of ignorance and misinformation, we're simply not going to be able to survive. This is very disturbing. I find myself very upset about it. That's what I think. What do you think? This is Two Buck Chuck.
And that's why I listen to the BBC. But even they are not immune to that. Yeah, I get the feeling that our reporters of today are more or less just performers and readers.
They are performers. It's tabloid journalism. Yeah. There is no such thing as news anymore.
And they don't really take the time, whether it be out of just being lazy or just not having the time to research their stories. Yeah, they don't take the time.
Yeah. Well, they only have 30 seconds.
Yeah, exactly.
The interesting thing was
they still draw a paycheck, though. They ran, even though they're wrong.
They ran a contrary story.
No, just kidding.
They ran a contrary story last night. But unfortunately, the story did not include a public retraction of what they had said the night before.
No.
So had you missed last night, you would have been left with
It's very nice that they provided better information than day after. And they talked to James Spann, and he had a chance to have a brief interview. James is one of the people who, by the way, has been on this show.
Right.
And
a couple of times.
Who gave really important and valuable warning information, and he was justifiably outraged about what had happened in that news broadcast. And they interviewed him. It would seem to me there would be a perfect opportunity for them to say, mea culpa, we screwed up.
Yeah.
They never said a word. They just put out there what their next version of the story, even though it contradicted what had happened the night before.
Well, you know, they might get sketchy details about, or again, don't spend the time to do the research. And to fill in the gaps of their story, they fill it full of sensationalistic, struck without warning, usual.
You got to understand, they've got to sell those feminine hygiene pads and that beer, man. That's what it's all about.
Actually, most adverts these days are about car insurance, it seems.
Yeah.
Ironic.
Yeah. But it's just sad that our fourth estate is dropping the ball when it comes to fulfilling their obligations. What I see is their obligations to provide information to the public.
Mm-hmm. When the story should be quite straightforward.
Yeah. This was a simple story.
Sure.
And in fact, it was a positive, upbeat story. There were great warnings.
Yeah, it does make you worry. Makes one worry about, if they're wrong about these straightforward stories, what about these other stories?
Yeah, well, I think the answer to that is clear.
Yeah.
I went blind watching Weed Trimmers commercial. Somebody should have given me warning.
All right. Enough of that. Back to the father of storm chasing.
Really?
David Hoadley.
I'm afraid that you gentlemen, especially Chuck, simply remembers Chet Hundley and David Brinkley, and nobody else does.
Yeah, exactly.
Edward R. Murrow?
Yeah.
Edward R. Murrow, yeah.
Or Cronkite?
Yes.
There were responsible journalists in the past, and we've lost them to be replaced by tabloid journalists.
To some extent, though, it's hard to point to one thing. You have to kind of think, we really have kind of a culture shift in the whole country where the public is rather impatient with details, with research that gives you that. They're more interested in the superficial, the immediate answer.
You know why that is, Dave? You know why I think it is?
Boy, you can answer that, you can get the Pulitzer.
Because they've been given a steady diet of superficiality all their lives.
They don't know any different.
They don't know any different. They think that's the way it should be.
Yeah.
They think life is supposed to be one continuous piece of entertainment.
Yeah.
The idea of actually expending some effort to learn different viewpoints and to compare and contrast different perspectives and think things over for themselves, nobody likes to do that. They want it to be the bang, bang MTV version of the world. Everything right. in 5-second sound bites.
Right.
Yeah. And that's the way it is. Wednesday, January 25th, 2012.
Thanks, sob, Walter.
Sob.
Yeah. It is a sob story.
Anyway. All right. As we were talking before.
Yeah.
I was going to raise an interesting little historical.
Yeah, you were going to mention, David.
Go ahead. Yeah.
And there's an interesting twist at the end of this, so I'll try to be brief. But the background is basically, I saw a book review in the New York Times some years back about the book called The Invention of Clouds by Richard Hamblin, and copyright 2001. And one of the key heroes, one of the key persons around which it is kind of built, was an amateur British scientist named Luke Howard, and he was a member of the early, what they call the Askasian Society in England, and he had just happened to decide he should come up with a name, because nobody else had done so, for the various shapes of clouds. So he came up with cirrus, stratus, cumulus, nimbus, presented it as a lecture, and eventually, make a long story short, it caught on, became popular outside of Britain. In fact, Goethe wrote a poem based on the four cloud types.
Really?
What is interesting is, because this one's caught my eye, was Richard Hamblin was a Quaker. I am a Quaker.
Ah.
And some people say that I am the first storm chaser. So here I am using terms developed
by
a Quaker.
Sure, that wasn't Quaker? I'm just kidding.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Well, you just killed my whole point there.
Gene's anyway, good at that.
It's an interesting symmetry there.
Yeah. Well, you know, you might find it also interesting. Do you know the name L.F. Richardson? Louis Fry Richardson?
No.
Okay. He was actually the founder of numerical weather prediction.
Uh-huh.
He wrote about numerical weather prediction. He published a famous book on it in, I believe, the 1920s.
Uh-huh.
But he actually did a hand calculation of a numerical weather prediction forecast while he was bouncing around in the fields of World War I as an ambulance driver.
Huh.
He was an ambulance driver because he's a British citizen. He was a conscientious objector and a Quaker. And as a Quaker, he was a conscientious objector. And they gave him a job driving an ambulance. And he is really the spiritual father of all numerical weather predictions.
Wow.
It's Lucas Fry, F-R-Y-E.
Lewis Fry Richardson, F-R-E-Y.
F-R-E-Y Richardson. I'll have to look up on Google then. You know, it's interesting.
Yeah, and it's a fascinating story. He's an individual who dropped out of meteorology, actually, because he thought it was diverting him from his real purpose in life.
Yeah.
And it's a fascinating story.
Well, footnote is also that I did go through ROTC, and I did serve years in the Army and Army Intelligence, excuse me, the oxymoron there, with the 1st Infantry Division of Fort Riley. I did choose Fort Riley because that's where the storms were. All my friends who were at Fort Holabird were going to London, Paris, Tokyo. I said, Hoadley, you got your choice of duty state. Yes, I did. Are you happy with your? Yes, I am. Where are you going? Fort Riley. Hoadley, you just spent 6 weeks in intelligence school.
I'll bet that was tough to explain.
How did you do?
Were you enlisted or commissioned?
No, ROTC.
ROTC.
So I went through as an officer and a gentleman.
Yeah.
Yeah, well.
I was an enlisted swine, but that's another story.
Oh, I would have talked to you once in a while.
So,
at a distance, though, if you bathe.
Back to this poem regarding the four cloud types.
By the way, Richardson wrote the famous limerick about... bigger whorls have lesser whorls that feed on their velocity
and
on to viscosity.
Yeah.
He's the author of that poem.
Oh, that's
I will
cool.
look him up. Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. This poem regarding the four cloud types, can that be found on the internet somewhere?
I have not looked for it. And, of course, it might be in German, so I don't know.
Well, sure if it's in German, you can find an English translation.
Yeah. Well, I haven't done that yet.
Hmm.
Anyway, interesting history.
Interesting stories.
Yeah.
Now, you're still planning on coming out this year.
Yes.
You still come out once a year or when?
No, I usually make a couple of three or four trips, so I not make as many this time, but there's a little bit more inertia since I am acquiring a little bit more seniority here. But I guess that when the time comes, and I certainly expect to chase locally. In fact, I'm kind of...
You're going to have to split your time between the grandchild and storm chasing. You realize that.
I'm thinking that maybe the Southeast might light up a little bit this spring compared to other years.
You know, my son lives in Virginia, and he has both my granddaughters there.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, they're not in the little town Doswell. It's down there.
No. One time. No. They're in near Virginia. Well, they're in Virginia Beach.
Oh. Interesting.
Yep.
So when you come out to the plains, where do you find the your breeding right at home? Is it the Dakotas and Montana and
the Northern Plains or what?
I think basically when I cross Missouri into Kansas or I leave Arkansas, actually when I get past Oak City,
okay.
West. And past
I-35
Kansas City
basically.
And west.
Yeah.
When I get out the flat country, then I feel like I'm out there.
Yep.
And you're still very much a Northern Plains chaser, or do you feel
No, I mean, I chase where the action
Where the storms
is.
Are. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So sure. you don't limit yourself much as far as...
No. Oh, no. I have a pretty wide range. In fact, On an average day, I might average, including my drive out and back, I might average anywhere from 650 to 800 miles a day.
Wow.
Might be for a week at a time, might be 2 weeks, whatever it takes.
So that represents
a
significant investment, especially
that's a total
these
investment,
days.
Yes. So when I say inertia to make the first trip, that's what I'm looking at. I'm looking at
1,500
a long
mile trip.
Drive.
Yeah.
But, I'll probably make it a couple times maybe.
And you've been doing that since 1956, which
yes,
is
sir.
Pretty amazing.
Yeah, it is.
Wow.
And doing it with class and dignity, I might add.
And you don't see that stopping anytime soon.
Well, I don't know. I don't. I hope it doesn't anyway. I don't see anything on the horizon that will put a brake on it. I expect at some point I will probably find that the miles are rather long, and then I'll just chase more in the Carolinas and the Delmarva and the East Coast and try to keep my hand in the pot somewhat.
One person I don't see much out anymore is Roy Britt. Have you heard much from him lately? Since he is he's in Richmond, actually.
Yeah, he's pretty well confined with medical problems.
Mm.
He has heart palpitation. I think he has diabetes, and he has expressed to me from time to time a reluctance to get away from his caregivers.
Yeah.
So he wants to stay close to them. He feels a little bit unsafe. Though he has been to a Denver conference once or twice, and he's thinking about maybe going to this one, last I knew. But he flies out, and then he enjoys the company, and then he flies back. So,
if you see him, do you see him on a regular basis?
No, I don't. And I won't be going out. I don't plan to this year, so I probably won't see him then. No, I've been asked to come down sometimes to visit, but he's not always been... I guess felt comfortable have me come in. I don't know why, but
okay. Well, who knows? I sure miss him.
Oh yeah. Oh gosh. Well, he's still got probably the best private collection of videotape of storms.
He's always collecting
all over the country.
Videos, right.
He's got hundreds and hundreds of different storm pictures, and he sent me copies over the years, and I have a collection of about 15 or 20. Videotapes of just 2 hours each, 2 hours of just hundreds of storms, and they're snippets taken by amateurs mostly, and some of them are quite dramatic.
In fact, you know, when he would come out to the plains, if it was a dead week or two, he would drive hundreds of miles just to track down.
Oh yeah.
These videotapes.
Yeah.
He was persistent. He would. Yep. He, I guess he's got a great collection. I could, probably one of the probably the largest one, private one of anybody in the world, maybe.
One of the things that Tim Marshall and I were talking about last time I had a chance to talk to Tim was this real question of, you know, a lot of us senior storm chasers are getting to the point where, you know, we're going to start kicking the bucket. And the question arises, what's going to happen to all our stuff? And in particular, the collection of images and videos and so on. And I know he's talked to you about this. There are no obvious simple answers, but do you have any thoughts on the subject?
No, I've talked to my family about maybe, you know, donating my slides and video to some, maybe one of the local colleges or something like that. Nothing specific.
Do you really think a local college is going to appreciate what you're talking about?
Whoever has a meteorology program, let's put it that way.
Okay.
And I don't know whether
it's
University
too bad that it
does.
Couldn't be all centrally located in one.
Well, I know there's been a talk about that, and it bounced around a year or two ago out about around Norman. There was some talk about having a library there. I don't know what's going to get that off of the ground.
I don't either.
Winning the lottery.
Actually, I'd like to shift the subject. We're probably coming down towards the end here. And there's one question that I'd still like to get some information from you. Over the years, one of the more dramatic contributions you've made are those marvelous drawings that you've put into Funnel Funnies and Storm Track over the years. What's your background in terms of your creative ability to do that? Were you trained in that, or are you self-taught like you are in storm chasing?
Basically self-taught. It's just a talent I had from the age three. The few times I've gone to an art school was never more than a semester or a few weeks. Okay. For various reasons, I dropped out. It was not as what I wanted to do.
Right.
Tim does have all of my originals as far as historical reference is concerned, so I'm sure that will survive me. But it was just all self-taught, basically, and just my own feeling for what other people enjoy.
They are so fantastic, and you're so creative. It's just amazing to me. Now, you did most of those with a ballpoint pen?
Yep.
Yeah.
And
that's
of course,
an amazing
most
medium.
Most of those have been digitized now and are online, accessible online.
Yeah, which are unbelievable. But, you know, I was talking to Tim about it, and he's got things that never appeared. So
at the same time, they kind of address a certain era in chasing, which, you know, the current time, the present time with the various kinds
of... Kind of hard to relate to now.
Yeah, it's a little bit less informal, less... it's a different kind of a culture, and I think that it would be hard for me to recreate the same thing today with the kind of chasing that people do now to find something funny, really, and original.
Yeah. Well, you had not only the artistic ability to express your ideas, but the ideas themselves were amazing, pretty much spot on in many ways. And, you know, it's one of those things that it's just, I don't know, I've always found astonishing about your many talents.
Well, it's, you know, I feel very fortunate in a way, very blessed to have come along at the time I did and to have been able to bring what ability I had, and I hope that it has helped to shape chasing a little bit.
Definitely the golden era of storm chasing.
And to kind of get it off on the right foot in some respect and maybe to temper it over the years, and maybe there's some service done.
I'm pretty sure you've done a huge amount of service, Dave. Anybody with a half a brain and an interest in storms knows about the things that you've contributed. So,
and it's still nice to see that some of the newer chasers are still researching the history of their hobby.
Yeah.
And coming up with, you know, learning about what you did and
who daddy is.
Yeah, basically.
Who's our daddy?
But at the same time, you know, I'd be very quick to say, and I don't mean this in a false humility way, but my inspiration, as I'm sure for many other people, is what's out there, the sky, the storms.
It's about the
That's
storm.
My spur.
Yep.
To me, I'm just a medium.
Yep.
Where I'm coming from is something that is much bigger, much more grand than anything that we can imagine.
Yeah, you've used your abilities to talk about storms.
But when you watch Discovery Channel, it's kind of disheartening to see that it's kind of like a West Coast chopper sort of. you know, internal conflicts between people.
What's popular on TV is beyond me.
Really, it should be.
About the storms.
Look up, the sky.
Look at what's going on, people.
Yeah.
Yeah, I always like Gene Moore's comment. It's not about storms, it's about them. And that's it's never been about you, Dave. It's always been about storms for you.
Yeah.
And we understood that, but you know, I'm not so sure the modern generation of storm chasers really appreciates that fully yet. Maybe someday they'll come back to it.
In a way, it's like many other things in the history of any society or any movement or anything like that. What we live now in now, the period, is like a bookend to where we were.
It sets it off.
It gives it value. It makes it distinct. And it's always going to be there. And it's always something we can look back on with some pride and some satisfaction.
I'm very happy to have been part of that.
Yes. All the people that were chasing in the early days, that's a special time for all of us.
Yep.
All right. Well, thank you so much
for being
on the show again, David.
Sure. Yeah. You're welcome.
And I'm sure we'll look forward to another show with you sometime.
I hope
so. Good.
All right. Oh, you have a good night.
Thank you.
Take care.
Good night.
All right. That was an evening with David Hoadley.
It was Daddy.
Yes.
It was Daddy. I haven't...
Well,
he's such a great guy.
He is.
David Hoadley, one of the greatest people you could ever possibly get an opportunity to talk with. If you really want to learn about chasing, this is the man that could just give you a wealth of information.
I went to the TESA meeting a couple of years ago, and Dave was one of the featured speakers. And I like to pride myself in being a fairly good public speaker. But I was just blown away by his presentation.
It was so matter of fact.
Yeah. Unselfconscious.
Right.
Captivating.
Did not and talk yet, down to you. He just has a level.
And no tricks. No. There's nothing artificial. He isn't doing anything to try to.
You don't feel like you need to go take a shower after you listen to his. Yeah.
It's just amazing to me. I was just captivated by what he had done.
And I don't feel the need to go out and buy wiper blades.
Yeah. Well, if Dave were ever...
Or Volvos?
If Dave were ever to go market some product, frankly, I'd probably have to go out and buy it.
What? Depends?
Oh.
Sorry, Chuck.
If he ends up advertising Depends, I'll probably end up having to use him eventually. Not yet, though. Well, I think that was fantastic.
Our next show is going to be on February 8th, and we'll post the next guest the week before.
So.
All right. For Chubuck Chuck and RJ Evans, I'm your host, Gene Roden. You all have a great night.
Thanks for listening. Join Gene Wednesday night, 7 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Eastern, live on ShockNetRadio.com. This ain't your daddy's weather radio.